This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to You're Making It Worse. We're here, we're queer, who cares? I'm Elliot Glazer.
And I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott.
Textual healing.
So, Dave,
what?
You know what? I don't appreciate you cutting me off.
We're keeping it in.
So Dave Chappelle has a new stand-up special, and lots of people are accusing him of homophobia and transphobia. And so, you know, just in summary, kind of boil down in his new special, some of the things he says. He calls himself a TERF, which is a trans excluding radical feminist. He defends J.K. Rowling.
She coined that, canceled.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. He defends J.K. Rowling's over being canceled. He says gender is a fact and then goes on to explain it's a fact because childbirth. He accuses the gay community of punching down on the Black community by canceling DaBaby, Kevin Hart, and himself. He talks about a gay person calling the police on him in Texas once. And he also talks about fighting a, quote, butch lesbian and beating her up, I guess, which is very strange.
Did you watch it?
No, I've always thought he's a little overrated, and I've just never been. I had friends who loved Dave Chappelle in high school so much.
Yes, yeah,
they watched like that big special that he did, like over and over again. And I just, even that one, I was like, I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Did you care about him? I mean, this is a tangent, but did you care about Chappelle's show at all? The sketch show.
I also didn't watch Chappelle's show. I know my brother loved it, and like
Everyone loved it, a ton of people loved it.
But
oh, I think it was groundbreaking.
Another one I never got.
It was
into
definitely.
It. Yeah.
I think it was a groundbreaking show. There was nothing else really like it. Singular thing. There was group shows. There was In Living Color. There were other shows that sort of, you know, showed the Black experience in that kind of way. But there was never like someone who really took over the mantle of Richard Pryor and he really sort of did that, and it was something that I think was really needed at the time.
Yeah,
and now it's needed now
got,
too.
Like it, I thought it was great. I just never like got into it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think he's a great stand-up comedian. But like you, it's never been like my thing. Yeah. But boy, if I were ever going to watch a special, this would not be it. People are talking about it in the gay community a lot because he really goes out of his way to talk about trans people a lot, like gay people and queer people.
In every single
special. It's so weird. Like that to me, ultimately, it's like, yeah, it's definitely problematic across the board to do that. And we can talk about like cancel culture and stuff like that in a second. I just truly, without criticizing his comedy at all, I'm just like, dude, why are you so hung up on doing material about trans people? It baffles my mind.
Well,
I genuinely understand it.
Even besides that, like, I feel like whenever you go down that road, there's sort of a level of like, you know, like what he's doing is wrong. Like it just fundamentally is wrong. He is wrong by the psychiatric association, whatever the association called identifying trans people and what gender identity is, as in terms of how mentally we process it. He is wrong fundamentally about gender. And So in considering that, he's taking an intentionally militant, and I don't think he's homophobic. I really don't. I don't think he hates gay people.
That's the thing.
I don't think he hates queer people. Or I don't think he even hates trans people, to be honest. I do think he's ignorant and has a warped understanding of what gender is. And he, because he falls into a trope of stand-up comedy that I fucking hate on such a level that I think is what's killing comedy in a lot of ways, is these comics who no one's going to tell me what I can say. No one's going to tell me what I can do. You can't cancel me. And they're so hung up on not being canceled that they refuse to evolve. They refuse to understand that it's not about your comedy being canceled, dude, or someone telling you what you can and can joke about. It's about society evolving and understanding that we're the differences among us, and that maybe the things that you thought or that we thought or the things that we said 10 years ago probably isn't appropriate anymore. And it's like,
you know,
he refuses to give up on that.
It's an interesting point, and I definitely hear where you're coming from. And it's almost kind of plays into, you know, my own suspicion, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm right or wrong about this, which is, I don't think cancel culture impacts change at all. I think, in fact, it does the opposite. I think it entrenches people. And when you tell someone that they're wrong and that they're a monster and they're an asshole, and you say, well, I'm going to punish you for being wrong, then people are just inclined to be like, well, fuck off. I'm going to keep doing it. I mean, I fucking do it with like little things online or like little moments when like someone's like, excuse me. And all of a sudden you're like, well, no, fuck you. And who the fuck are you to tell me what's right and wrong and all that shit?
I don't think the cancel culture is necessarily part of this. And like, he had this big premiere at the Hollywood Bowl where he had like Lizzo and Brad Pitt and Stevie Wonder and all these people just praising him as the greatest comedian ever and all these things, even though all of this news about what he was talking about and the anti-trans messages that he had on in his special was all out there, very out there and apparent, and everyone knew it. And yet all these celebrities are out there being like, yay, Dave Chappelle. And it's like, you can still appreciate the man's comedy and what he has done and his ability as a comedian, because he is a very good comedian, but also be like, but dude, you're wrong about this. You need to like step up and recognize maybe. And hey, if you're not going to step up and recognize it, well, then it's up to corporate companies to be like, well, then we're not going to pay this dude to come back and do another special, or we're not going to pay tickets to go see him live, or whatever it is.
Well, GLAAD actually put out a release pushing Netflix to pull the special. And I was like, I mean, honestly, I agree with you. I'm like, I don't think he's homophobic. It's a little nuanced, which is why it's kind of confusing, because I don't think he's a bad person or necessarily even homophobic. I just think he's, like you said, he's warped. But my thing is, even if he's not homophobic, I just don't understand the hyper focus on talking about trans people's bodies and gender,
because it's attention. It's all about attention. He knows, literally, he's done this every fucking special. And I think, and I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but I don't know what the viewing rate of his shows are, but if he's continuing to talk about something, it's not because he wants to be with a trans person or he's gay in any way. It's because it gets him attention. And
I hear you. I think I would take, and again, this is my own self-fulfilling. I always think I'm right, but I would take the opposite, which is I think it's for power. You know, he's this legendary comedian that everyone likes. And for the first time, he has people pushing back on him. And he's saying, no, I'm going to say whatever I want to say. And that's the problem,
and it's the same thing with Trump. It is exactly the same thing with like the Trumpian politics too, that
Taylor Greene.
Exactly. They're above consequence because they can say whatever they want. It's freedom of speech. And it's like, well, you're right. You can say whatever you want, but then these corporate companies and me as a person who's buying tickets and buying content can be like, well, no, you don't deserve this. And I'm going to make sure that the company that I'm paying a monthly service for knows that I don't think this should be on that platform. And that's not cancel culture. That's consequence culture. That is consequences for your actions. And he is directly doing something because of power. And it is up to people to call him out and take away that power. You know what I mean?
I like what Sonny Hostin on The View calls it accountability culture,
yeah,
which I always appreciate, because it's like, it's not necessarily the desire to cancel these people. And I mean, yes, obviously a lot of people, especially online mobs, are like, wipe them out, make sure they're gone forever, which I don't think is going to do anything.
It's not healthy. It's not good.
I don't know if that's good, but I feel like just making somebody accountable, even if they are, like Brent says, going to dig in their heels and be an asshole about it. Again, it's just like, dude, all of that being said, I actually do think that I don't see it as a power grab. I see it as, because this is a man who could, he's a comedian who can literally talk about whatever he wants. I mean, it's that subjective.
And he's so talented that he could talk about anything and it would be funny. He doesn't need to talk about this.
And that's why I find it bizarre. And I don't necessarily think it's a power grab. I don't know what it is. And you know,
also, what skin does he have in the game either? It's sort of like,
that's why it's so odd.
This has nothing to do with you. If you are not a queer person, if you don't have a trans person in your life, if it doesn't impact you in a direct way, sure, you're a comedian, you can talk about anything, but like, comedy comes from truth. And what truth do you even know about this?
Well, maybe this is his way of coming out as trans, you son of a bitch. We don't know.
That would be a goop.
Not even joking.
We are joined today by someone who basically worked on The Bodyguard. We just had this discussion, and now I'm going to attribute the film The Bodyguard to him. Dylan Marin. Hello, Dylan.
Hi.
No relation to Whitney's character The Bodyguard. No,
that's actually the opposite of what we're trying to push here. I am related yes. to the fictional character that Whitney Houston played in The Bodyguard, and do not tolerate any counter-narrative.
Do you really think that knife... Do you really think that sword could cut that scarf? I don't think so.
Oh my God. Thank you for bringing that up. So here's the truly embarrassing thing. I thought I knew The Bodyguard movie well.
Yeah.
What can you tell me what scene you're referring to?
Oh my God, Dylan.
You cannot,
when pronouncing your name, you cannot call out a Bodyguard reference without knowing the pivotal scene.
No, I'm guessing Alan made it up.
Where Whitney Houston goes to, she's finally going over to Kevin Costner's place for the first time. It's their first date. They just had the I Will Always Love You Dolly version at the bar moment. And she takes off her scarf and she throws it in the air. And he takes the sword and it falls on it.
Yeah, and that's when
they make love. That's the first time they get it wrong.
Right. Okay. So that is a deep cut from the movie. I would say, like, my mind is committed to the opening shot in her mansion in LA, because that was my first exposure to the industry. And I was like, well, that sounds great. And then, and then obviously the scenes with the sister. I'm not going to say anything else.
Scenes in the snow, running in the snow cabin. Oh, the snow with the white old man who's like, you have to go after him.
Yes.
And grandpa. Oh, and God, every, so good.
And every music scene. So that's what has stays in this hard drive, and the rest I've kind of let go of. And I can't wait to refill it with all those scenes.
I love this. You know, Brent and Elliot are also on this podcast, but we could probably do this.
No,
I don't think you need us, Alan.
Dylan, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is so fun.
You're like a full multi, like you do so many things.
Wow. I am honored. Wow. What if I just received it like that? Wow. Okay, next question. Wow. I just demand adoration. Yeah, I'm honored that you say that. I feel, I was actually just having this conversation recently that I trip up when someone asks me what I do.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I wish I had like one title that I could say, and I could just be like, I do this, done, great. Whereas I feel like the way I've constructed my career is I kind of just go to whatever medium the next idea takes me to.
Right.
Which robs, I suppose that's really fun and cool, but I also think that from the inside, you're just like, I just want one singular artistic identity.
Right,
Or you could do what I do and lie and just say you're in publishing because no one ever asks any follow-up.
I love that.
Is that what you do?
Are we watching? You say that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Are we watching the other two?
Oh, I am. Yes. Yeah.
Love and the wonderful pass where I think in one of the later episodes when everyone lies about what they do in LA, so that they don't have to have the conversation.
Don't have to have.
Well, it's kind of, I feel that a lot too when people ask me, especially people who don't live in LA, who are in entertainment or New York or LA, where I don't really know how to say what I do.
Yes.
I'm a writer, comedian, sure.
Totally.
But I also do drag and I also do like serious journalistic writing stuff as well. Yeah. So it's sort of like this weird combination of shit that I'm just like, I pay my rent.
Yeah.
That's what I do. That's what I do.
Yeah.
I pay my rent. I live.
Yeah.
And you take it. But no, I really respect that because when you don't, there is a lot of pressure. And I mean, maybe you felt this too early on in your career where, you know, you do a lot of many great things. You're a writer, you do, you do theater, you're a comedian. I mean, would you call yourself even a, like you do stand up? No,
I don't really do stand up. I think that's the hardest part because like when I bill myself as a comedian, I'm like, everyone's like, oh my God, he's so serious. You know, whereas like when I go give a college lecture and it's funny, people are like, oh my God, this is funny and engaging. So
your podcast is, and Cop has a forthcoming book, Conversations with People Who Hate Me. Yeah. It is funny.
Well,
it is very funny.
I really appreciate that. I think the premise is itself comedic. But I, you know, you listen to it and you're like, you know, some of the conversations are like, there's a violin playing in the background. So I've actually this is the stuff I talk about in therapy, but why not share it with you all today too? But I think comedy is such an attractive world to belong to just because it's like one word. It's like there's a sexiness about it, even though we all know it's very
It's
hip. It's cool. But I think like my work has kind of taken me away from or conversations with people who hate me has like taken me away from comedy. And yet now I'm, you know, doing some TV writing. So it kind of, there's a bit of an identity crisis in terms of art form, I suppose.
So let's talk about your podcast because I wasn't aware of it before these guys sent it to me.
Great.
And I rarely do this, but I read just the title. I'm like, that's such a great idea.
Oh my
God. Tell us about that and tell us about the process and everything.
So the quickest way I can say it is that in 2016, 2017, I was making a lot of very political videos from my perspective, which is to say socially progressive, short satirical videos, interview videos. And these videos were doing really well. And the important detail is that they were doing really well on Facebook. You know, that one year where Facebook was like video, we are the video place. We love it.
For me, it was just mostly like videos about making like turduckins or like weird cakes I would never make in a million years.
1,000% the bird's eye view tasty videos. So I was making videos for this corporate funded digital television studio called Seriously.tv, which I really loved, and I got to make a lot of work. And as a formerly independent creator, it was just so nice to like have a studio and have a group of people who I was working with. Anyway, this is all to say that the videos really took off, and they took off on Facebook. And because it was, you know, you could argue the beginning of the era that we're in now of like hyper political division in digital spaces.
Right.
I was getting a ton. The more popular the videos became, the more hate I was getting. The reason I share the detail of Facebook is that unlike YouTube or Twitter, on Facebook, when you're getting a message from someone, 90% of the time, it's from their actual profile. So you are getting... you're getting a message that calls you a faggot, a piece of shit, a moron, you know, a hack, a beta male. And then you click on the profile picture of the person who sends
beta
it. A beta male? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't even register. I don't think I'm a beta male even. I think we're gamma or zeta or further down the list.
Yeah.
But
by the way, I've called Alan all of those things.
Yes. Anyway, and that's what matters.
He starts every single day
with further down the list. No, that's great.
It's his morning meditation. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. We love the morning meditation and thank you for that. But I would, so in getting these messages and comments, I could click on their profile picture or their name because that's a hyperlink. And then I'm just there on their page seeing all of these pictures of their lives and posts that they wrote that they weren't necessarily to an audience, but they are public because it's a public platform.
Right.
And I was basically like developed a coping mechanism where I was constructing these fictional backstories for them because I was like, I just need to know that they're human beings. It's scarier to me if they're these anonymous people who hate me. I need to construct these full three-dimensional things. One thing leads to another. And of course, just to be clear, my first instinct was not to have conversations with them. My first instinct was take a screenshot of it, make fun of their typos. You know, you need
to get them fired. Right.
Or, and you need to get that power however you can, because it feels so degrading to get that torrent of negativity. And then one thing leads to another. And I make a video where I scroll through some of these things. And one of the people in that video, notices their message and they get in touch with me. And what ended up happening is we ended up having a really, really incredible conversation on the phone for like an hour where we got to know each other. He was a high school senior at the time. And his experience in high school reminded me so much of my own. He felt very alone. He felt isolated. He felt bullied. I had a conversation with him. Then I just wanted to have conversations with more and more people whose hate screenshots I had collected that turned into the podcast Conversations with People Who Hate Me. The only epilogue of that quick genesis story is that then I wanted to expand the show and I started moderating conversations between two parties who were not me, who got into it with each other online.
That's great.
It is such an interesting, oh, I'm sorry, Brent. It is just it really interesting in that like we've all received our fair share of hate. And like, I think we all, I mean, the three of us definitely deal with it in different ways. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love getting any kind of hateful message. It's not an invitation to send me hateful messages, but I'm not wounded by like a bad comment on the podcast or like a review or like anything like that. It doesn't really get to me. And I would say like these guys definitely probably
it's a spear through the heart.
I don't read them. I have no problem doing it. Whereas like I think because we mentally disassociate myself and realize that the hate is coming from a more sad place within them. Like there's something in their background. Do you find that with some of the people who send you hate that's where it's coming from?
Totally. Well, quick question, because everyone was sharing how they take the hate. Elliot, how do you take the hate?
Just the same as Brent. Well, actually, that's not true.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's... Well, no, just it's the same as Brent. I really can't handle it. But that's why I really don't... I don't read comments, and it's just... It's too brutal. It's just too brutal.
Yeah. I totally get it. Well, but in terms of... to your question, I think there's not one monolithic story of them being sad. And I think... You know, this is something that my friends certainly warned me, or when I was first experiencing this, I had a lot of friends who would soothe me by telling me they're just sad, lonely people. They live in their mother's basement. Right. And I think that's a fantasy we tell ourselves.
It is.
Because
it absolutely is.
The really troubling thing, I'm just adjusting my seating position here, but the really troubling thing is that totally anonymous vitriol online, many times it can come from people who are hurting on their own, right? And I've definitely found that many times where they're like, I felt lonely, so I took it out on you. I felt insecure, so I took it out on you. And I just celebrate those moments because if someone's going to be that vulnerable with me, it's like, great, 100% this feels like we're connecting. And that to me is an apology itself. Again, because we're also talking about a system, platforms that encourage us to spew this negativity, even among our own community, especially among our own community, and we can get into that. But I think that the alarming thing is that, in fact, a lot of the times my guests have really robust social lives they're just literally social media users who have access to a keyboard and social platforms that are asking them to share what they're thinking as soon as they think it. And access to the people who they think those things about in an ecosystem where there's a new person to hate every day.
And they're also,
that's what,
sorry. I mean, I was just going to say, and the medium now also allows them to feel like they can get through more than ever before. You know, even if they're not getting a response, yeah. I think firing the bullet is enough for them to feel emancipated enough to, you know, or they can feel like they can actually do it and get away with it, and that it will make some impact even if it doesn't reach the person. I think it's beyond just the idea of like people in their parents' basement. It's not, that's not the internet anymore. It's
which, by the way, Elliot is in.
His I literally am. Right? Yeah, literally, so true.
He literally is.
That is amazing. Again, here's the twist. Elliot, it's you.
I'm nice.
Look at you. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, Dylan, how often have you, because I think this is a really compelling and exciting and interesting idea.
Thank you.
And I did some, these guys have heard the story a million times, but I did some canvassing during the midterms a lot, actually, in 2018. And I just remember being absolutely struck with how like engaging and polite and kind all these Republicans were.
Totally.
And, you know, in my head, because of Facebook, you're like, oh, everyone has guns and everyone's mad and they're going to scream at me and I'm going to get shot. And then in reality, you're like, no, they're people. And we disagree on some, you know, some pretty fundamental issues. But how often are you getting on with someone who, quote, hates you? And you're like, oh, there really isn't a whole lot redeeming about this person. Or is that almost never?
Great question. And I think the truth is there's such a filtration process to the podcast because they need to be 18 years or over. They need, they're under 18, but their parent consents to them doing the recording, you know, so which is a bigger hurdle almost. They need to be down to talk. And then there are a lot of conversations that I record and I don't release for a variety of reasons. So when you finally get on the podcast or even when you finally get on the phone, you know, it's a pretty self-selective group of people who are down to have the conversation, know that it's not a debate show. So I'm not looking to like debate them. Certainly not slam them, but also like I'm uninterested in debating them about capital T, capital I, the issues, because I think there are a lot of shows and media that offers that. And I'm much more interested in hearing about the human side of where they were when they wrote that comment, why they wrote that comment, I hope they listen to how I feel when I receive that comment, or my other guest who received the comment when I'm moderating. And it's funny that you bring up canvassing, because so many people who do deep canvassing, you know, the high intensity, like spending a lot of time with someone, they reach out to me about the show because it's so, when you knock on doors, you find the same thing. And what is so not online about that is that when we're online, there's very little encouraging us to see the three-dimensional human on the other side of the screen. Whereas like when you knock on someone's door, you literally see their welcome mat and you see a picture in the background and you see
their jack-o'-lantern.
Totally. Yeah. Like you see these little pieces of shrapnel of their lives, and you, even if you vehemently disagree with them and even if they're really rude to you, you at least are like, well, I'm not going to punch you in the face right now, which digitally we can do. We can digitally punch people in the face very easily because I'm not standing in your doorway right now. And I don't see that you have tea on the oven. And I don't see that you are watching reruns of Golden Girls, you know, like on your TV.
Man, after this podcast, at least two out of three. But you know, it's interesting because there was a Reddit page that I discovered recently, that was fairly dark and it got some attention in the media. It's called the Herman Cain Awards, and it was basically about, you know, it's screen grabs of anti-vaxxers who ultimately got COVID and then generally died from it. And it was, you know, it sounds horrible and it was horrible, but there also was a part of you that was just kind of morbidly fascinated with these folks and how the other side lived. And I ended up going to it a lot for a short period of time. And I started occasionally, you know, everyone was blocking out names and stuff, but they didn't do it consistently enough. And you could occasionally find these folks online and you would go to their profiles and you'd be like, wait, this is a person. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, they made their bed and you know, they should have gotten vaccinated,
Mm-hmm.
But this is a person, they had kids, they had a family, their family always, you know, loved them very much.
Yeah.
And they, you know, outside of the political memes that I might disagree with, they were, you know,
yeah,
good, honest, decent people. And that's when I ended up writing a comment to this Reddit that was, that received more vitriol than I've ever received in my life. But but yeah, so no, I mean, I think it's no, important. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
There's no empathy for that. And there's a great documentary now that I just watched this weekend that sort of applies just to what we're talking about, 15 Minutes of Shame.
Just watched
which
it.
Which I think a lot of people are, they're calling it like a cancel culture documentary, but it really isn't. It's about online vitriol. Mm-hmm. And it's about that impulse that we have to sort of get someone or like, you know, get back at someone or call them out or cancel them in their own kind of way. And the documentary does a really good job of sort of talking about why we do these things, why these things, how these things have grown with the internet and the repercussions of some of them. And it's,
you know,
it's really like, even like with the COVID thing, like I don't understand anti-vaxxers I don't get that. I don't get where they're coming from, but I also never have been on board with the idea of like publicly shaming them. There's so many articles about that. And it really just kind of blows my mind that we go that
I think low. That the, there's like the way that I see it in terms of what we're talking about. Like I do feel like there's two polar ends of the internet now. One is to call people
kittens.
One is to call people hypocrites and to get them to admit they're hypocrites, which they're never going to do. But that is one end of it. One end of it is to get them to be to announce that they're hypocrites, which is not going to happen. The other end of it is the virtue signaling, where at the end of the day, you want to appear as the most empathic human being possible, and that you above all others has considered the widest spectrum of people because you have the most empathy. And that's kind of how I see it now. It's hypocrites and like full-blown empaths.
Or performance of empathy. I mean, I think empathy is such a like buzzword right now. And obviously, like, my work is literally about like engendering that, and so the fact that it's a buzzword, I actually only think is good. But as long as we, like, I'm aware, you know, like my whole, the mantra that came out of the podcast is this idea that empathy is not endorsement. And I think people flock to that phrase because it's alliterative, and it's because it's quick, and empathy is not endorsement rolls off the tongue. Very Oprah. And so I think like what I'm also doubly aware of is that while I also still stand by it, I created that mantra as like, I mean, I didn't create it thinking like this is a mantra for the people. Like literally I wrote it in my notes app because I needed to essentially make a note to myself to give myself a permission slip to keep going with this thing, because it is a mind fuck when you are having conversation after conversation with people, or as you were saying, canvassing, and you're like, wait a second, I don't understand what's happening right now. I really, really, really like these people, and I really, really, really disagree with a lot of what they're saying. Caveat, of course, I'm also talking to people on our side who also send hate, and I'm interested in that too. So that's a little different. But empathy is not endorsement was this whole idea of like, you know, you can empathize with someone, and empathy itself does not endorse what that person believes.
Totally.
Now, I say that not just as a tangent to talk about a mantra that is on a shirt in the merch store, but I think because go check it out. What if this was just to sell that one t-shirt and I end the interview right now? I gotta go
10%.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. We'll end the interview. But I think that I'm aware that I have submitted a phrase to the empathy industrial complex, as I see people calling it these days.
Yeah.
I still believe in and stand by that phrase, but I think empathy is an action, and it's not just like a sticker. It's not just a tweet. I think the thing I'm starting to say or recently articulated to myself is I really don't think that empathy is something that can be taught. And I certainly don't think it's something that can be like engendered.
But that's the thing people want to like, they want to not just teach you, they want to shame you into being as empathic as them, which is crazy.
Which
is not going
to
work.
You want to talk about then the circle meets, because then the hypocrisy people pointing out the hypocrisy of that would be Correct. I think the what I'm trying to say about empathy is that I don't think it can be taught through mandate. I do believe that you can help people build the spaces where empathy thrives. And conversation, I have found one-on-one, offline conversation is an amazing way to engender that empathy. Yeah. And I'm not saying that it's like, I am just an amazing saint, and through these conversations, I have decided to empathize with
them. Well, that's something I want to ask you about.
Well,
like that, yeah. I mean, this podcast is called You're Making It Worse, and I feel like everyone listening to this conversation is going to be like, y'all are hypocrites. Your podcast is about hating people, which, I mean, it isn't, but I can see how people can go there. So,
well, you can be critical without hating.
Of course. But I'm just saying, like, the average listener, we are called You're Making It Worse. We're being pretty critical. Mm. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's calling out our own, not our own hypocrisy, but, like, but before we wrap up, I just really want to know, in sort of a fun way, like, because it is sometimes really fun to hate someone. It really is fun.
Yeah, there's a sport
to sometimes
it.
Just fucking hate someone. Like, right now I'm dealing with car dealerships, and I hate every fucking straight car dude. Every fucking straight car dude.
Which is
I
every
want
car
to
dude.
Strangle.
Yeah.
No, because the Boring Gay we had on the podcast before, he's a massive car
loves
guy.
Cars.
And he's gay.
Oh. Big car guy.
He loves cars.
I
love
anyone who
him.
Works in a car dealership is heterosexual.
But yes, so I wanted to ask you, who do you really hate? Like, just if you had to choose one person to, like, just hate.
There's got
to
be somebody who's unrepentant enough where empathy is not something that forget about teaching them empathy.
I mean,
and
it could even be
you
Hitler.
You can say Alan. You can say
yeah,
Alan.
You can say
I mean,
me.
It could,
yeah,
it could
Alan.
Be whoever, you know?
And that's why I wanted to come on here. this is my long con. I played it coy, Elliot, when you reached out, and I was like, oh, sure, yeah, my plan is working. I had like dollar signs in my eyes. I started bleeding.
You're not going to get much from Adrian.
Well, I think, is there anyone I truly hate? This is going to be such an annoying answer. Like, I think, okay, I'm going to answer it in the, like, caveat I always give, which is that I, like, none of this stuff is a mandate, right? So, like, there are people that have been truly unkind to me, and then as I've pursued them for a conversation, they have continued to be unkind to me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're no longer worth my energy.
Right.
Do you know what
of
I mean?
Course.
Like,
yeah.
And
yeah.
There are also, like, I've gotten death threats. I've gotten really just, like, cruel, cruel things. I genuinely believe that someone should call that person in with love. And I think that someone should catch them. I am not the person for the job. And that's what I see to all my guests when, like, we're having conversations about, you know, like when I'm trying to pursue a guest for a moderated episode. And, you know, a lot of people, especially women of color, especially Black women, are like, I just get too much hate online and it's so vicious. And I fully understand that. I mean, that's a lesson I had to learn early on when I started doing moderated episodes. I thought a lot of people were going to be so excited to do this. And I also think it's important, a very important thing for me to remember is that, like, this is just not for everyone. And there are some people who are simply trying to survive in online spaces who have... who are not like, yeah, you know what I want to do? I want to, like, find the humanity in this person because they're dealing with such a torrent of such hateful abuse. And I fully understand why they're like, I don't have the energy to do this, but let me not bow out and let me try and give you an answer.
Yeah, it could be the IRS guy. Like, it could be literally anybody.
There is one person in high school who did something... You know, as far as bullying goes, it's not the, like, worst thing that's ever happened in the history of the world, but it was so humiliating at the time. And he has never reached out to me to, because I think the most devastating thing of all is I don't think he even remembers it, you know? But,
right,
like, he was just, like, a jockey, older, straight boy who one day... he asked that I take it was Halloween one day. It was Halloween. Part of his costume was wearing an athletic cup. And he asked that he take a picture with me, and I was Waldo that year. And I don't want to brag, but that was a very creative costume in 2003. But he asked I take a picture with him, and then he pulled his, as the picture was being taken on a disposable camera, look it up, he pulled his cup out of his pants, his underwear, and held it over my face, cementing that image. And you know, it's different. It's, yes, digital pictures proliferate more freely, but I think there's something about the fact, like, now this is on a device and it's being developed somewhere, now someone else has this photo that, like, it fills you with a shame.
Ugh, what an asshole.
And the way to, like, totally. And I think so. I have such strong feelings of resentment and hurt towards him that he, and especially that he hasn't even reached out, because here's the truest and saddest thing. I don't even think he remembers my name.
Right.
You know, like, I have to remember his.
Well, calls you Tommy.
Tommy. Yeah. I was trying to actually was Elliot. Yeah.
I was trying to put two random words together and they came out Tommy.
Listen, honey, it's my new stage name. I'm Tommy.
Dylan, you're really genuinely inspirational.
Oh my God.
And I loved we loved talking to you and having
that says a lot coming from Brent, because he doesn't find inspiration in anything.
Except for like bathroom quotes. But yes, where can people find you online?
I've kind of like taken a backseat to social media, which is very healthy. I recommend it to anyone who's wanting to try it. You can find me at Dylan Marin across all social media.
Dylan, your website has everything. DylanMarin.com.
My website has your new everything.
Book. You have a book coming out in January, right?
So, we don't have to get into this. You have lives to lead, but I just found out the book was delayed because of the supply chain issues that we are all facing
COVID.
Well, COVID, I think COVID is part of it, but I don't know. There's a paper shortage. Anyway, as far as I know, my book is now coming out in March. You can go to DylanMarin.com to find everything, or Tommy. Just Google Tommy and see what comes up.
Thanks again, Dylan.
Thank you for having me, and what a pleasure to be here.
And another thing.
So this was a very difficult topic to research, but I figured it would be worth the price to talk about poppers, because there's a new book out called Deep Sniff by Adam Smith, which sounds like a fake gay name. It's a book about poppers called Deep Sniff. Deep Sniff. It's like a rich deep dive into the history of poppers, which are technically amyl nitrates, which used to be considered pain relief for pain from angina.
I always assume angina is pain in the vagina.
Yeah, same.
It doesn't make sense that it's not. Every time
I know,
like,
it's wild.
I'm like, oh, it's like that's like menstrual cramps or something. Yeah.
Sounds like vagina pain.
It does.
Poppers for your vagina. For your vagina pain. But anyway, so poppers are used, I'm sure a lot of our queer listeners know, but poppers are used to create a sudden brief rush of passion that crucially for many gay men can help loosen the anal muscles.
Yes.
Brent, hold on for dear life.
Yeah.
This is from an article. It's not uncommon for groups of men and sometimes their straight friends on a dance floor to pass them around and sniff them together. And I was curious, A, what your thoughts are on, A, if you've used poppers, and B, what your thought is on them.
Yes, I did buy them once. And Elliot, obviously, I hope that you're going to be honest about, you know, starting your day every day with a sniff, sniff. But
he actually owns a brand of poppers.
I bought them once when I had my roommate. I live with my roommate Noah, and I told him about it because you have to like keep it in the fridge or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Don't drink this." He's like, "What the hell is this?" And I told him all about poppers, and he's like, "This." He was like, "This is a little worrisome," and I ended up trying it once, and it instantaneously gave me a headache.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not for me. I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
I had the same exact experience. I thought I would try them once. They instantly gave me a headache, made me dizzy. And I truly, I have no judgment toward it, but I do not. I mean, you and I are both very vasovagal when it comes to dealing with things of the body and like things, all of that stuff. Yeah. So dealing with the idea of like sniffing and having a reaction already is tough. I could barely get through researching this stuff.
Yeah. But
I had this.
I like how you texted us being like, it's evergreen. We can talk about it. And they're like, I know you're just sitting there like barfing the entire time.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. I was getting very lightheaded.
There are certain words on this podcast that you can use that are similar to like Pee Wee Herman's word of the day, where you can just see Brent and Elliot just like fall down like Rosebud. Like literally they will just fall apart at the mention of the word. That's our word of the day.
Ellen, what's your experience like? Yeah.
I've of course used every drug known to man. And I have used them. Yeah. But I don't like them because I don't like, I like drugs that like make me euphoric, that make me sort of excitable and like happy and whatever. I've
never seen you do drugs in my life, but yes, go ahead.
You have never?
I've never seen you do
drugs. I guess we met at a time when I kind of stopped using. Like, I didn't use any, like, party. Like, you didn't know me when I was going to, like, clubs and stuff.
Wow. This is fun. This is
club exciting. Kid moments in New York. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have used poppers, you know, here and there. But I just don't like that feeling of being, like, nauseous and dizzy. And it just makes me kind of nauseous and dizzy. And it doesn't really.
Ugh.
Also, I'm not the best bottom in the world. So,
okay.
Like, I feel like the
it's more for bottoms primarily.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is what I don't understand. Okay. So technically, I mean, I guess it's known that poppers are more for bottoms because they loosen you up for butt sex.
Yeah.
But what I don't understand and what I learned in doing this research is that it is a common, I'm reading a journal of medicine.
But yeah. Right.
It's a commonality for gay men in groups and sometimes their straight friends to on a dance floor to pass them around together,
which is, and I'm like, just wait, absurd.
Well, because it's like
to me it's absurd because it's like the drug is it's not like weed or coke or whatever. Like, I get the party drugs, but poppers are just like, if they're for your butt,
they're not just for your butt. It's like a muscle relaxant in a way. So it just kind of. The intention at least is supposed to sort of give you this sort of delirious, like relaxing, a relaxing sensation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And on the dance floor, that can be fun if you're really laying it on thick to Enya, like Brent does. You know what I mean? You have to get down and squat.
Really dancing until you throw up.
Yeah. Dance, like Brent's dance move is called Orinoco Flow, and it's him squatting on the dance floor.
Yeah.
Clutching his ass, hoping that it doesn't fall out.
Well, you know, I mean, here's the reality. I mean, there are some people that don't need any help having anal sex, and Elliot is one of those people. Yeah. So this has always been something.
He has a self-lubricating bussy. He doesn't need.
I will be a little judgmental for a second, and I do think you're allowed to be judgmental when it comes to drugs. I am from the Midwest, so I am familiar with what white trash looks like, and I always thought. the one drug you don't do because it's for downriver white trash is whippets. And which isn't to say there's anything wrong with doing whippets.
No, whippets are fun.
I have no doubt they are, but like, it's just, that's like the trap. Like it's
I mean, don't do them.
My brain.
Don't do them.
That's the trashy drug. And whenever I see people in videos, it's like popping up on OnlyFans occasionally now. Someone will be sniffing poppers in a video.
Oh wow.
And whenever I see that, I'm like, it just looks like they're sniffing glue, which is so low rent to me.
Well, but
and sometimes their face and eyes are bloodshot. You're like,
the
this
reason
is
why
not
it's low
sexy.
Rent. The reason why it's low rent is because a lot of times in the Midwest, what you're seeing is not the result of whippets, but the results of meth. And they're using whippets to sort of continue that high. Whereas if you just I'm not advocating this, but if you just do whippets just in general, it can be a fun brain-killing moment. But
I had my wisdom teeth removed. I know what the experience is like, and I enjoyed it. very much. But have you guys
hooked up with other guys who have used poppers?
Oh, I've never seen poppers. No,
never.
Nope. Wait, that are you kidding?
I'm not kidding. I've never. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I meet people who are a lot classier than you guys. I don't know.
That's so funny. So the only experience you had with them is you using them once.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. I've had many experiences of people using poppers in my presence.
You know what's fun to note too? That in 1990, a group of lawmakers added poppers to banned products under the Consumer Product Safety Act.
Oh.
But then in 2021, the FDA Pride 2021, this past year, the FDA literally put out a warning against poppers, saying they saw an increase in reports about hospitalization and deaths from poppers.
And that blew me away. I tried to find.
Surprising.
Yeah.
I feel like that's some straight math there. I feel like there might be something more happening there.
Feels interesting. Feels bizarre, right? Like I feel like
those deaths had to come from something else, some other drug in their system, not just the poppers.
Okay, so we have anti-vax folks who think that public health officials are lying to us about
poppers poppers are such a momentary thing. It's like it's not like cocaine or meth or whatever that like you can actually like. I mean, I'm sure you can overdose on it, but you'd have to take a lot of poppers to overdose.
That's a fair point, but this is probably the most important question of all, since we've sort of cracked open Pandora's box when it comes to Alan's drug history. Have you ever had someone blow cocaine into your asshole? Has that ever happened to you?
No, I'm not gonna elaborate on any of that. Thank you.
What would your aunt say? Brent, what would your aunt Ramona say about something she heard on today's show?
Believe it or not, I'm also very vasovagal.
my Aunt Joanne would say, does a turf come with surf?
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah.
Very funny. Very funny. How about Aunt Anne?
My Aunt Anne would say, I'll tell you who I hate. I hate Sheila down at Hallmark, who only lets me buy two Precious Moments figurines because apparently there's a shortage.
Oh my God.
I have
a shortage there too.
My God. Love it.
Well, thanks for listening. I'm Elliot Glazer.
I am Brent Sullivan.
And I am H. Don't quote me on any of the drug use, Scott.